This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. In January, during his second inaugural address, Governor Peter Shumlin focused almost exclusively on education.
We spend more than 50% above the national average, and K-12 spending in Vermont has grown faster over the last decade than in any other state in America. But the following simple fact ought to alarm all of us. With the vast amount of money that we spend per pupil in Vermont, we have failed to move more low-income Vermont kids beyond high school.
Governor Shumlin called for a $17 million investment in child care subsidies, with the money coming from the state's earned income tax credit. The governor also wanted Vermont's 17 career and technical centers to work more with local businesses to get a better understanding of the skills employers need. And he proposed a 3% budget increase for the University of Vermont and the state colleges to be used for scholarships and financial aid for Vermont students. In addition, Shumlin called for a tuition reimbursement plan for students who study science, math, and technology and stay in the state after graduation. Some of those proposals met with success when the legislature got down to business. Others didn't. Today on the program, we're going to spend the full hour with Governor Shumlin to go over what he saw as the successes and failures in this legislative session, and he'll be answering your questions about state priorities. If you have a thought you'd like to share with the governor, give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Governor Shumlin, thanks for being here.
Hey, it's great to be with you, Jane.
You spent the entirety of your inaugural address talking about it and the initiatives that you'd like to see pass to boost our educational goals. What do you see as the greatest success, some concrete success from the legislative session on that?
Well, you know, I got about 90% of the agenda that I outlined in that speech through, and that's a huge victory. You know, governors never expect to get it all. I didn't think we'd get as much as we did.
And so the Free Press said you batted 750 this year. You think you did even better than that?
Well, you know, on the education piece, we did. No question about it. Listen, here is the challenge. Vermont now has the third lowest unemployment rate in America. We're down to 4%. I mean, really, it's getting to be a challenge to find workers. When you talk to our employers now, they say, Governor, you know, we've got jobs. We just can't find enough Vermonters who have the skills to do those jobs with the work challenges that we have right now. You know, my point is we've got a good education system in Vermont, lots to be proud of. But if we don't make it the best, we will not succeed in a prosperous future. It's that simple. As I mentioned in a speech, the big challenge is that with all of the money that we're spending, and after last year's town meeting votes, it's $17,500 per pupil per year, one of the highest spending, if not the highest in America, we haven't moved the needle a single bit in terms of moving low-income kids beyond high school. And we know that in this workforce, if you only have a high school degree, you're pretty much destined to a low-wage job. Now, that wasn't true when I was a kid growing up in Vermont. So that's what's changed. This is what we got through. I said in a speech, you can't learn if you're hungry. And we have too many kids who are hungry in school. Vermont is now, after this legislative session, the first state in America where lunch is free. You go to school, you get a free meal if you qualify for the federal program. You don't have to chip in 25 cents, 50 cents, the stigma and everything that comes with us.
Right. Basically, people who were eligible, students who were eligible for reduced price lunches now get free lunch.
Everybody's in free if you qualify. That's important.
And that was about $322,000 added to the budget.
That's correct. Second, we said that it's time for us to bring in all the players and make each student's journey through the educational process more flexible and more tailored to their needs. So every kid is going to have, starting in grade school, it's a specific plan for them that ensures that they get the education that they need, tying education to workforce, to career, and what educational levels you need to attain to achieve different careers. That's important. Third, we passed, long awaited us, something that we call early college and dual enrollment. All it means is that with all of the good money that we're spending on high school right now, every single kid in Vermont will be able to get to up to a year of free college credit, a whole year, while they're in high school. Now, when the biggest obstacle to getting low-income kids beyond high school is cost, that's a big deal. Two ways that'll be delivered. One, with CCV and state colleges and private colleges right in the classrooms that our students are sitting in now. They never have to leave high school to take the Brattleboro model, I call it, and expand that statewide so that we certify our teachers, the colleges, the private, as well as state colleges and oversee them. That's a big deal. Second, any student who wishes to take a course at CCV or the state colleges, can do so, and the money will follow the kid. So that's huge.
That applies to private colleges as well?
That's correct. So, you know, there will be both private and public entities in there ensuring that we get more kids getting college credit for the money that we're spending on high school now.
But one thing that you didn't get passed was the Vermont Scholars Program, which was aimed at reducing the tuition burden on Vermont students who study in the STEM field, the science, technology, and math, and who stay in Vermont after graduation. You weren't able to get that passed, which would have provided, for a four-year degree, a year of tuition reimbursement if they stayed in the state.
That's right. To make college more affordable, we got three-quarters of the loaf. We got the early college, the dual enrollment, and we also passed the first increase in higher ed spending in 5 years in this state and dedicated every single penny of it to reducing the cost for Vermont students bound for UVM and the state colleges next year. So it literally means that any student that goes to UVM next year and is a Vermonter will not pay a penny more than they paid the year before, with a combination of President Sullivan and UVM and Tim Sullivan, the chancellor at state colleges, holding down tuitions to more reasonable levels, combined with us increasing our infusion. The piece we didn't get, which we hope to push through next year, is a simple concept that if you graduate in a science, math, technology, engineering field, which we desperately need if you talk to our employers, and you stay and work here for 5 years, we will pay your entire final year of college tuition and your final semester if you're getting an associate's degree. And that's all important. So, you know, the pieces that I wish we'd gotten were that, as well as the investment in early child education that I called
for. If three-quarters of the loaf, maybe the quarter of the loaf that you didn't get was the early childhood education, didn't get required pre-K for every community passed, and didn't get that earned income tax credit passed, which would have delivered $17 million to child care subsidies. That seemed like a big priority. So if you're saying you got 90%, that 10% seems like it's a little bit outsized, that big proposal of yours.
We got part of it, and this has been missed by the press. We found the dollars in the Department of Education to ensure that any community that chooses to go to publicly financed pre-K, which is important, that we're going to fund that for the next 2 years so it won't be on the backs of property taxpayers when they make that choice. So that kind of got lost in a shuffle. That's in there. It's an administrative effort on our part to make sure that we put our money where our mouth is.
But any community that wants pre-K, not requiring communities to offer pre-K.
That's correct. But the big obstacle for communities, as you know, is the fear of cost. So we've got a two-year transition dollars in there for them now. Now, I was disappointed that we didn't get the $17 million biggest investment in early child education in the history of the state. And, you know, my belief is that if we spend the dollars early, if we give kids a strong start, we're going to get better outcomes, more kids succeeding, getting through high school and getting beyond high school. So we'll go back at that next year. Now, the disagreement there was it was a philosophical disagreement with the legislature. I believe that, as you've heard me say many times, so many you're probably sick of hearing it, that Vermont's taxes, income, sales, meals are high enough and that we don't have more capacity there right now, that every time we think of a new program, we can't turn to Vermonters and say, hey, we got a new program, we're going to ask you to dig into your pockets, we're going to raise your taxes. Instead, I said, let's look at what we're doing well and what we're not doing well and try spend existing money better. Now, that's something government hardly ever does. But as a business person, that's an important principle to the way I run government in Montpelier.
Sounds like the legislature didn't think that was a better way to spend money.
They agreed with us on early child education, the goals of it. They didn't agree that we shouldn't do it without simply asking Vermonters to pay more taxes. So that's where the disagreement was. We'll go back at it next year.
You're going to push for, again, this earned income tax credit plan?
I'm going to push for expending the money that we're spending on poverty programs in a smarter way to get better results. And here's the point, Jane.
So are you going to change where you think the money should come from then instead of the earned income tax credit?
It's too early to say what I'll do. You know, we'll look at all the options available to us. But going back to the earned income tax credit certainly isn't out of the question. If we can find other thoughtful ways to spend money better, we'll do it. Listen, here's the deal. If we were winning the war on poverty in this state, I'd say let's keep doing exactly what we're doing. We're one of the most generous states in the country, as we should be, to support folks who are having a tough time. But we're failing. As I just said, we are spending a ton of loot. We haven't moved more kids beyond high school. So we got to look at what the money we're spending now and ask this question. Is there some ways that we could spend some of it to get more effective results?
We're talking today with Governor Peter Shumlin. We're talking about how his priorities for the legislative session fared. We're also going to hear from many of you. If you have questions, if you have thoughts for the governor, priorities that you'd like to see him deal with, you can give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Suzanne's on the line from Panton. Hi, Suzanne. Go ahead.
Hi, Governor.
Hi.
I have a question as far as the kids that are excelling in elementary and high school and what programs that you have available or looking to make more challenging programs for these kids. Because it seems like we're concerned about getting the kids that are having problems with school, moving them up, which is great. But I'm finding that the kids that are excelling aren't being challenged enough.
Well, Suzanne, you ask a great question because really my education package is designed to help all learners. As you probably know, I'm dyslexic. I learn differently. If I hadn't had an individual teacher giving me, frankly, tutoring after school before we had special ed in Vermont, you know, I wouldn't have ever learned how to read. And, you know, it's helpful to be able to read when you're a governor. So what this plan really does is say, and by the way, a huge thank you to the Teachers Association, the NEA, the Principals Association, the School Boards Association, the superintendents, the state colleges, UVM, the partnership that came together to make this happen. But really what we're saying is let's give each kid starting in grade school the flexibility to get the experience that they need with the flexibility that we now have because of technology and other options that didn't exist when we just lined kids up 20 in a classroom, stood at the blackboard and threw it at them. So talking about early college and there's an opportunity for any student who happens to be excelling to go take college courses while they're in high school, get credit. So that's the whole point. Give each student the flexibility to maximize their potential.
We have some questions about taxes. I want to move on to taxes because we've got so much to cover with you this hour. Let me read you a couple of emails that we got. Jim in Chittenden says, thank you for holding the line on proposed tax increases, especially sales tax extensions and excise tax hikes this past session. Tom in East Barrie works in the grocery industry and says the proposed new and increased taxes on tobacco, beverages, and candy would have seriously impacted Vermont's grocery businesses. Your opposition to these unnecessary tax increases prevented further loss of business out of state, which in turn would have cost hundreds of hardworking Vermonters their jobs. And Mark says, Governor Shumlin, you have repeatedly opposed the notion of reforming the Vermont income tax system such that wealthy Vermonters would pay a higher percentage of their adjusted gross income. Could you tell us what non-anecdotal evidence you use to support your assertion that such reforms would drive wealthy Vermonters out of state? And before you answer, let me bring people up to speed on that. The legislature basically backed down on a tax proposal that had been gaining quite a bit of steam right at the end of the legislative session. And that's what Mark is talking about here, this income tax reform that would deal with adjusted gross income. And basically, legislative analysts said this would raise the taxes on, I think, about 14,000 wealthier Vermonters, mostly reduce the taxes on middle income Vermonters. You did not like this proposal. You said we had agreed not to address major tax reform. So Mark wants to know why you think this would drive wealthy Vermonters out of state. And I want to know if you're going to support that legislative plan next January.
So let's back up to the first two callers to do the first part of the question first. Listen, as I travel around Vermont, my job is to listen to Vermonters. There were two things that puzzled me about all of the taxes that the legislature chose to raise, income, sales, meals, some taxes we never heard of. You know, the House passed a tax on sugary beverages, thinking that it would reduce obesity. When it got over the Senate didn't like that, so they decided to tax bottled water because they think bottled water is bad. You know, I was like, well, what are we supposed to drink here? I mean, they thought of all kinds of new things. My point is this. We didn't need the money, period. I don't believe in raising taxes on hardworking Vermonters when we don't need the loot. We didn't need it. So it was that simple. It wasn't a complicated plan. I do believe that as we come out of this recession and we're making really good progress, one sure way to freeze it in this tax is in its tracks is to raise every single tax that you can think of. So that's where I came in philosophically. I've been clear on that since I was elected. This isn't new news. Second, on Mark's question, listen, I do not object to asking wealthy people to pay their fair share. I actually helped write Vermont's existing income tax code, which is the most progressive in America. It says wealthiest Vermonters will pay the most, middle class will pay less, and low-income people will pay almost nothing. That's what tax codes are supposed to do. My point is a simple one. You can't do it twice. We're already doing it. We have the fairest tax code in the country. So this notion that some of my progressive friends have, and I'm the most progressive governor in America, that I am refusing to fix something that should be fixed is what puzzles me. We fixed it. Our wealthiest Vermonters pay the most. Now, in terms of the argument that people move out of here, listen, and regardless of the evidence, last week I went to a fundraiser for King Street Center, you know, incredible program right in Burlington, rebuilding a building for low-income kids, kids from all over the community where they really get a strong start from 0 to 5, great programs all the way up through high school, tutorials, tennis lessons, things that kids would never have access to. Guy was there giving him a fairly significant contribution to King Street. I said, God, you know, where'd you get that suntan? He said, Florida. I live there 6 months and a day now because your income taxes are too high. I mean, if you don't believe this is happening, go out and talk to people. But here's the point. I don't object to a thoughtful approach to moving to adjusted gross income in Vermont. I don't. I supported the Blue Ribbon Commission plan. I said clearly there's ways we could make our tax code even better. There's no question about it. Mark's right about that. I'm not saying we can't improve it. I'm saying you can only prove it incrementally because we're already doing it. But if you go out and do that, the only point I want to make is the way the legislature did it didn't do that. What has been reported in the press, particularly from VPR, is not true. What the plan that was presented to me by the legislature did was ask almost half of the people who were going to pay higher taxes on their thrown-together plan, they made less than $100,000. That is not wealthy. That's a plumber and a nurse. That's an electrician and a school teacher married. $100,000 is not big money in Vermont. So their plan was going to ask almost half of the people who make $100,000 or less to pay the bill for the $30, $40, $50 cuts that other people were going to get in their income tax.
$100,000 or less, you said?
That's correct.
But
so
now,
you all presented it as, well, you know, it's all rich people are going to pay more and all middle-income people are going to get a cut. It just isn't true. If you look at the sheets, we're happy to show them to you. Almost half of the people that were getting hit made $100,000 a year. So my point is, don't do tax policy on the fly. Don't just sort of scrap it together and go out and, you know, change the income tax policy and say, Vermont, when you don't know what the consequences are. And surely don't do it when you don't know what you're doing. And that's what they were doing.
Well, absolutely show us the sheets. We'll put them right up on our webpage because
great,
the sheets that you were using were also tax plans from 2007. So there was a lot of confusion around this bill, around whether it was revenue neutral or not, around who was going to be paying. And I would absolutely welcome having those sheets
up
there.
We'll get them to you. But here's my point.
Yeah.
That's exactly why we shouldn't have done it, because no one knew what they were doing.
Well, we didn't do it, but will you support it next year? It sounds like Shep Smith,
that.
It sounds like John Campbell think that they have a deal with you that we will do it in January.
This is the conversation that we've had. Listen, as has been reported by VPR over a year ago, on this show, I support the Blue Ribbon Commission's recommendation that we can find a way to reduce rates for all Vermonters, and show that our income tax rates are more competitive with other states. I support that effort. I do not support the cobbled together plan that was sent to me by the legislature that didn't do what they thought they were doing.
I don't want to push you without getting anything here, but let me just ask you very clearly, are you going to push for tax reform in 2014, and would that include moving to adjusted gross income?
You know, I'm happy to work together with the legislature, with the speaker, with the president pro tem, as I told them, to try and get it done. I'll be honest with you, it isn't my top priority. I'm focused on delivering single-payer health care to Vermonters. So we're the first state in the country with a sensible health care system. I'm focused on growing jobs. I'm focused on finishing our education agenda. I'm focused on moving to green, clean, renewable power. You know, these are hardly conservative goals, I might point out. I'm focused on balancing budgets and doing the things that we got to do to really make a difference. So, you know, if it can happen in a thoughtful way, I'm for it. But to suggest that it's going to be in my top 10 list, you know, that's not really, it isn't.
More with Governor Peter Shumlin coming up. We are talking to you today as well. Give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Governor Shumlin's on the show today. He's sharing his thoughts on the bills that passed and those that didn't make it out of committee. Governor Shumlin, I heard that you were poised to sign the end-of-life choices bill today. Have you done that already, or is that on the agenda for later today?
That's on the agenda for 2 o'clock today.
2 o'clock. And so this is something that you've supported. What do you think the immediate implications of signing this bill are going to be. What do you see? Anything that we're going to notice changing?
Well, you know, first of all, I got to say, this has been an effort that's been 10 years in the making, been discussed in the legislature. It's been a very thoughtful, you know, democratic, civilized debate as we do things in Vermont. And when I sign this bill, I will be the first governor in the country to ever sign this into law. It's happened in two other states by referendum, not by legislative and gubernatorial action. But I think it's been a good discussion. There's strongly held feelings on both sides. Both are thoughtful. But, you know, this is my dad's 88th birthday today. And happy birthday, Dad, by the way. And when my mom came up to visit, she's younger than my dad. I can't say her age. She'll get mad at me. But she's not all that much younger than my dad. And when she came up to visit me recently, she said, you know, is that bill going to pass? And I said, why, Mom? She said, you know, I doubt I'd ever want to use it. But if I'm terminally ill, if I'm in extraordinary pain, if I know that I'm going to die and I have a few days left to live, it gives me peace of mind to know that I live in a state where I have that option. That's why I support the bill. I've talked to too many Vermonters who say to me, you know, this will give me peace of mind. And so I think it's a thoughtful response to what's a difficult issue that none of us want to talk about, which is death.
Anything you can say to put Carolyn at ease? She writes to say she's disappointed that you are going to sign S-77. Carolyn says Vermonters will lose their freedom of choice if assisted suicide becomes legal here. Is the governor ready to be held responsible for the abuse and murder that will happen under the cover of this law?
You know, if any of that were true, to be honest, I wouldn't sign the bill. Oregon, we pretty much copied Oregon's bill. Oregon has had no abuses of that nature. And the safeguards in this bill, as passed by the House, and the Speaker Smith did an extraordinary job on this bill with his team over there. But basically, this is how it works. You have to make a request and have an evaluation by two different doctors before, obviously, you can move forward. You also need a 15-day period. You also have to be of sound mind. So you can't just sort of, you know, this can't be imposed upon you. This is a choice that you have to really think out. You have to be of sound mind. You can't, you know, obviously, mental illness. Obviously, if you're not, you know, thinking clearly, if you don't have all of your faculties, you know, it's a no-can do. So the reason that we haven't had the kind of abuses that Carolyn's concerned about in Oregon is because they put the safeguards in place and we adopted those same safeguards.
We got a note from Jackie who says, how long will it take for the GMO bill to be completed and how afraid are you of lawsuits regarding this? And this is, of course, the labeling of foods made with genetically modified organisms. Passed the House, didn't pass the Senate this year.
The House did a great job on a bill. I think they've made it as legally tight as they can, and I expect that the Senate will work on it and get it to my desk next year. So I'm looking forward to signing it. I'm a big believer that Vermonters ought to know what's in their food. You know, I'm not going to speculate on how frightened I am about lawsuits because obviously, you know, when governors speculate on things like that, it sometimes gives those who want to defeat you all kinds of information that we don't necessarily need to give them. But here's the point. Vermonters should know what's in their food. This is good common sense. There are many countries that are ahead of us on this one. I'm convinced that the market's going to push this one. As you know, Whole Foods has already said, listen, if you don't label your food, we won't sell it. I'm hearing rumors that there's bigger food distributors that are going to be taking similar policies.
There's a big push for Walmart to do that.
That's correct, and others. And, you know, so I think we're going to get there, but I think that this bill will help push the conversation so that not only will Vermonters have some idea what they're eating, but I think you'll see other states, once we have the courage to do it, join us in doing so.
Another big issue that a lot of people were really focused on this year that passed was marijuana decriminalization. And let me just recap the bill for people here. The bill makes it a civil offense rather than a crime to possess 1 ounce or less of marijuana in Vermont. And those caught carrying marijuana would receive a $300 to $500 civil fine rather than a criminal penalty. It would be similar to a traffic ticket. You think the legislature got this right?
They absolutely did. And I got to say, you know, again, this is an example of a legislature that got a lot of really hard work done. I want to say this is one of the most productive first halves of the biennium I've ever seen. Having said that, you know, on this one, there's two pieces to this. The first is, how do we take the law enforcement dollars that we're spending right now in this state and spend them more wisely? This is how, you know, by prosecuting small amounts of pot, we're not doing much for our criminal justice system. So we're joining many other states in decriminalizing marijuana charges. But the other piece of this is they also passed a very thoughtful opiates bill. Now, I would argue that if you want to talk about the biggest threat to our downtowns, to our quality of life, to a low crime rate, which we've always enjoyed in this state, to our family members being destroyed by an epidemic, It's opiates, it's heroin, it's OxyContin, it's all of the issues that were that are driving crime in the state. Think about this number for a minute. What these heroin dealers do, as you know, is they come up from the city, they give it to you for free. You're hooked in about a week or so. Then it costs you, at current rates in Vermont, about $95,000 a year to support your habit. That's a lot of crime. So my point is simple. Let's take the valuable health law enforcement dollars we have and fight that challenge, because if we don't get that one right, it will compromise our quality of life in this great state from border to border. Everyone thinks, oh, you know, it's just one city and not another. It is everywhere. It's an epidemic. It's not just low income. It's middle class Vermonters. This is striking too many people in our communities, and we've got to have a much more serious conversation about how we fight opiates. The legislature made a good start with the bill they're sending me.
Let's go to the calls. We've got Isha on the line from Dummerston. Hi, Isha. Go ahead.
Thank you. Governor, I was disappointed that you are unwilling to raise taxes on the wealthiest Vermonters. There are studies that show that wealthy people do not leave a state because the taxes are higher. I got those academic studies from James Haslam at the Vermont Workers Center. I'm sure he could provide those to other people, too. And there are needs. You mentioned earlier that we don't need the money. A lot of Vermont's farmland and forest land is being lost to development. The Vermont Housing Conservation Board really should receive more funding than it does. I do appreciate that you fully funded it this year, whereas Governor Douglas had tried to cut it out every year. Also, people on VHAP, working-class Vermonters, their health care costs are going to double starting January 1st. So I would like to see you raise taxes on people who can afford to pay more.
Governor Shumlin?
Thanks for your call. You know, we just disagree on that. The only reason that I disagree with Isha isn't that I disagree with the principle. It's that we're already doing it. And, you know, one of the best-kept secrets in Vermont, perhaps, is that because we have the most progressive income tax in the country, because we ask the wealthiest to pay the most, we're down to 3,000 Vermonters who pay 21 cents of every single income tax dollar we take in. Think about that. 3,000 people in a state of 625,000 pay 21 cents of every dollar. That's the way it should be. But we do lose them to New Hampshire. I know you're looking at it from the Scott Farm there in Dummerston. We do lose them to Florida every single year. And, you know, my view about success in business is that you keep the customers that you have and keep them happy, keep them staying, keep them coming back, and then you try to build new customers. And if we could increase the number of people who are paying income taxes in this state, you know, we'd all be better off. So, you know, we just see it a little differently. We're already doing it, as I've said a million times. Don't want to sound like a broken record. I don't disagree with you philosophically. It's just when you look at the numbers, we're down to a small number of people paying a large percent of the tax. And I'd like to not only keep those that we have here, but build more of them.
Well, on that note, we got Ann in Hartford who emailed in to say thank you for attempting to keep the legislature from raising taxes. I agree that we're taxed to death in Vermont, and Vermont is not a tax-friendly state to open a business. I think we need to work smarter at cutting waste and not raise taxes. But while we're back on taxes, let me ask you about the gas tax. This is something that did pass. We've all seen it at the pump now this month. When we had Shap Smith on the program pretty deep into the session and talked about the gasoline tax, he fairly reluctantly admitted that he thinks this is a broad-based tax, which you have said you didn't want to raise any broad-based taxes. How do you define broad-based tax if the gas tax is not one?
I don't. Fair enough to call a broad, you know, the gas tax a broad-based tax. I mean, sometimes, you know, as governor, you read things in the press and you go, really? Is that what I've been saying? I mean, this is what I've been saying. Listen. I mean, I've made the argument. I won't make it again, but let's just do it very briefly. I think our income taxes are perfect. We ask the wealthiest to pay the most, the poorest not to pay anything. That's the way it should be. I believe our sales taxes are as high as they can be, and frankly, too high. We drive too many people to New Hampshire, as the last person just suggested. So, you know, I just don't think you can do it twice. So we've got a high tax policy. We've got a progressive tax policy. Let's leave it in place. Now, I sometimes read the press and they say, governor has taken the no tax pledge, you know, like some of these Grover Norquist nuts, you know? I haven't done that. All I have said is, you know, my philosophy is that if I can balance budgets without asking Vermonters to pay higher taxes, that's where we should go first. And that's what I've done for three consecutive years. It doesn't mean I won't. It doesn't mean we never will. I'm just saying we will only do it if we absolutely need to. Now, the gas tax is an example where we absolutely needed to. It was a bipartisan consensus that when we're losing the battle with our crumbling roads, dysfunctional bridges in this state, and we're actually starting to close the gap, believe it or not, it would be a nutty time to send $60 million back to Washington, D.C. this year alone because we lose our federal match. And the way the transportation fund works is for every 20 cents that we raise in Vermont, we draw down 80 cents from Washington, D.C. So it would have been $60 million next year and a year after that. I mean, it's hundreds of millions of dollars for Vermonters. It just doesn't make common sense. So, you know, if we need to raise taxes versus let the state crumble, I'm all in. I'm all in. And the gas tax was a clear example of a difficult but sensible bipartisan choice that the legislature made with us.
Now, I, for one, have never said that you took any tax pledge.
No, you're right.
But you did say no broad-based taxes.
Yes.
So you're just saying this one was a broad-based
tax. Right, and I've made reference to broad-based taxes, and I shouldn't. What I mean is that to balance the general fund, the transportation fund is a different fund. As you know, it's funded by gas taxes. But to balance the general fund, as long as I've been governor, I have not seen the need to raise what I call broad-based taxes, income, sales, meals, in order to balance the general fund. I've done it the old-fashioned way for three years in a row, cutting instead of taxing. And I want to continue to do that as long as I possibly can, because I think that's the recipe for economic success in the state. It doesn't mean that I'm some kind of, you know, no-tax nut. It just means I don't think we need it.
All right, more to come with Governor Shumlin. We're talking today about the legislation that passed this year, the legislation that didn't pass, looking at his priorities for the rest of the year. And listeners, if you have questions, post them on our Facebook page or call 1-800-639-2211. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm, and today I'm sitting down with Governor Peter Shumlin. If you have a question for the governor about state issues, give us a call at 1-800-639-2211 or post your questions and concerns at vpr.net. Just click on Vermont Edition. Let's go to Douglas calling in from Fairfax. Hi, Douglas. Go ahead.
Hey, Douglas.
Hey, I have a two-part question for the governor. The first part is, what is Vermont's current policy regarding incentives towards attracting big business? And the second part is, do you have any plans of being more aggressive towards attracting big business so we can get decent wages and decent benefits in the state?
Well, we have a whole series of what we call VEPSI incentives that encourage companies to either expand here and increase their workforce or come in from out of state and increase their workforce. And they've been very effective. They've actually won awards for being some of the most effective targeted tax package increases that actually result in jobs instead of just giving money to big companies that take it and run. So I mean, it's really a well-tested and very thought-out program. It does very, very well. Now, I am on the road and on the phone and meeting businesses all the time to help have them grow here. And we're making success. I mean, you're calling from up in Franklin County right now. You know, the fact that we landed expansion at Milan, as an example, this winter, you know, is a big deal. That's a company that it's the biggest employer in Franklin County, private employer. They make a great product. They have been there for a number of years, but as you know, they wanted to expand downtown. We got them to through Act 250 in 29 days. We competed with all kinds of not only other states but other countries because they've got operations all over the world. And when I asked the CEO at the end, you know, how'd we get these jobs? How'd we win these jobs? He said three things. He said, you got a state where it's small enough where the governor does call you. And, you know, you can pick up the phone, talk to the governor, get problems solved. Second, he said, you know, you're a state that actually gets us through processes quickly. And third, and most importantly, and this is what really moved me, he said, we've been in Franklin County for years, and you've got the most innovative, dedicated workforce of any of our operations anywhere in the world. And that's why we want to expand in Vermont. So we got a great story to tell. We've got great VEPSI tax credits to go with it. I'm out telling that story. And I do think that that's why we're bringing industry here. We're bringing jobs here. We're expanding the jobs that we have. And I think it's not coincidence that we have the third lowest unemployment rate in America right now. And the two states that are beating us have all kinds of oil and gas and other things to drill for that we don't have. So we're doing okay. Things are looking up.
Let's go to Marla in Randolph. Hi, Marla. Go right ahead.
Hi, Jane. Hi, Governor Shumlin.
Hey.
Pleased to talk with you today. My question has to do with the threat of nuclear power. And I'm thinking of the nuclear spill that happened in Japan over 2 years ago. Governor Shumlin, what are your plans to keep Vermont green and free of nuclear threat? I'm a proud native Vermonter. Thank you.
Well, thanks for calling, Marla. You know, we are launching what I think is probably the most aggressive effort in of any state in the country to move to green, clean, renewable power. And I'm proud to say that in the little over 2 years that I've been governor, we've, as an example, we've doubled the number of solar panels in the state. We hope to double it again in the next 12 months, 24 months. We're making real inroads, as you know, harnessing the wind and our streams and our fields through biomass, and obviously pushing energy efficiency as hard as we can. In terms of nuclear, I'm a strong believer that Entergy Louisiana should have shut down the nuclear plant down in Vernon on time a year ago this past March. We are in federal court with them right now, as well as the Public Service Board process to try and make that happen. I have to be a little careful about what I say on the air because, as you know, I call them the litigation company. They seem to leak, not tell the truth, and litigate. So, they've always got a lawyer listening to me. But let's put it this way. I believe, will win that battle. We will shut down that old tired plant, and we'll continue to build renewables so that our kids can have a bright future. And, you know, it doesn't escape me as a politician who cares about serving the public, in a world where politicians don't like to say the word climate change, certainly in a country where they don't, we should all be startled that for the first time ever, scientists, as of last week, reported in the New York Times, reported that we have more CO2s in the atmosphere right now than at any time in 3 million years. 3 million years. Think about that for a minute. So I join those in believing that we cannot move fast enough, not only to save this planet for our kids, but frankly, it's also why we're growing jobs in the state. We've got more green, clean, high-tech jobs per capita than any other state in the country. That's a big deal. It's because of our energy policies, Marla, not despite them.
One of the big agenda items that you had this year was to tax break-open tickets. And that $17 million, which you estimated would be generated in revenue from that tax, would go towards a thermal efficiency effort. As we know, break-open tickets, not something the legislature supported. That thermal efficiency program basically died because it didn't have that funding source. I mean, that seemed like a big item in your agenda to address climate change, to address environmental issues. Is that a failure this year, do you think?
It's certainly a failure this year, and to be honest with you, it's been a failure for every year that Vermont's been in the heating business. I mean, let's talk about this for a second. We have done so well in this state in terms of electric efficiency. Through Efficiency Vermont, award-winning, smart program that we all pay for in our electric bills, we've drastically reduced the amount of juice that we're burning in a state. You know, it's a national leader. We have done abysmally on thermal efficiency. So this all gets technical. Thermal efficiency, what's that mean? Plain English, we heat too many of our homes with oil in this state because we've got no other way to do it. And because we have old houses that leak the doors, the windows, older buildings, we send that heat out the doors and windows, and it's costing us a fortune, and it's terrible for the climate. So I came up with the biggest single investment thermal efficiency in the history of the state. The legislature wasn't thrilled with my funding formula. So we'll go back at it, you know, working together with them next year to get it done. So yes, it was a failure this year. It's been a failure as long as there's been governors and oil heat, and we got to get this one right.
Let's go to Robert, who's calling in from Bethel. Hi, Robert. Go ahead.
Jane. Hi, Governor. How are you?
Hey, how are you?
Good. It's Robert up on Hooper Hollow.
Hey.
Couple things. You know, one of my biggest concerns right now is the deadline to get high speed. But today, you could comment on that. But last week, I paid my taxes, $936. And I called the town hall and talked to the lister. And I said, what percentage of that number goes to the schools?
Mm-hmm.
She said, Robert, about $700. That's quarterly.
Right.
So I put calls out to the supervisory board in Windsor here. John down there, who's the head, wouldn't take my call. And then since last Wednesday, I just around town over the weekend and the last week, just talked to different folks about their feeling with the contraction of the student numbers in the school and the growth of the supervisory board to a point where it's obsolete, I think.
Mm-hmm.
The principal in the Bethel school was just awarded a $12,000 raise. He's making over $100,000 with 23 graduates. And then they have a second principal who's making $56,000.
Robert, let me move you along here. Do you have a question for the governor? Are you saying your taxes, too many of your taxes go to the schools?
I'm asking the governor, who is watching the supervisory education boards across Vermont, specifically in Windsor County, because I think it needs some serious reengineering.
Well, thanks, Robert. And, you know, you hit it on the head. The education spending that we're doing in a state, the rate of growth is not sustainable. Here's the challenge. As a governor, I don't control that. That's just the truth. As you know, we're big believers in local control, and you're doing the right things by getting involved, asking the questions of your superintendents, of your school boards, and getting in there and starting to make a difference. Because I sit here every year as governor saying, school boards, you know, please hold the line on spending. In fairness to them, they did a good job over the last 3 years holding a line on spending. Until this last year's town meeting, they were pretty much zero budgeted for 3 years in a row across the state. That's a big deal, because that wasn't happening for a long time. Last year, there was a 5% increase approved by voters across the state. And, you know, these decisions are made first Tuesday in March, local town meeting, we go vote our school budgets. And that's where the decisions get made. So we need to all get involved in showing up for our school board vote, showing up for our town meetings, and being heard. Because, you know, this is not one that Montpelier can solve for you. It's got to be solved at a local level, since we really believe in local control of our schools.
We got an interesting question from Sarah, who posted on our Facebook page saying, Utah is looking into how to reduce their reliance on federal money in the face of continuous budget cuts. Is Vermont doing this or looking into it?
Well, we are, and we're making some changes. As you know, one of the great accomplishments of the legislature was that they passed the first ever designation for the old LIHEAP program, which is the money that we spend to heat by heating oil for low-income Vermonters. And, you know, we're not a state, regardless of what political party you're from, that's ever going to let Vermonters who can't afford it freeze in their homes. We're just, you know, we got big hearts. And so as the federal government, in their wisdom, you know, keeps chopping that program, I always end up scrambling for millions of dollars to try to fill the gap. We finally allocated $6 million in this last budget to ensure that no Vermonter freezes in their homes. So that's an example of where we're replacing federal money with state dollars. Here's our challenge. Utah and the rest of us can all look at this crazy sequester effects and try think of things that we can do, but none of us have enough loot to replace federal funding. I mean, you know, the lion's share of our budget is federally funded. So yes, you know, we're prepared. Yes, we're ready, but with what? If they really go at it, we're in big trouble.
Another area where that seems to be a concern, we're looking at the farm bill, which will be heading to the floor of the chambers pretty soon, and we'll have to see what happens with that. But certainly cuts to the food programs, the food subsistence programs like SNAP, are on the chopping block.
Right. We're talking about basically what we call, you know, we used to call in the old days food stamps, you know, food aid to people who can't afford food. And as you know, Senator Leahy and Senator Sanders done an extraordinary job passing a farm bill in the Senate that protects those interests. The Tea Party folks in Congress are going to make it much tougher for Representative Peter Welch to try to hold on to those gains as hard as he's trying. So who knows what they'll do? But there are so many areas where if the federal government continues to shift costs to the states, you know, we have to make some really tough choices. And what we all need to do is not give up. Call up those folks in Congress. We got the best congressional delegation in America right now with Senator Leahy, Senator Sanders, and Congressman Welch. But call the other ones up. Say, listen, leave a message in your voice box. This makes a difference to us. We don't want Vermonters going hungry. We don't want them freezing them in their homes. We don't want cuts to our military furlough, the green, you know, our Green Mountain men and women who are fighting so hard for us. You know, like, this is crazy stuff. Stop this.
You named last week Mental Health Commissioner Paul Dupre. He's going to be a new commissioner of the Department of Mental Health. I'd like to hear if you think your mental health plan is on track. I spoke with the department this morning, and they told me that a safety inspection of that 7-bed Middlesex facility that was happening on May 14th found a few safety issues. They're waiting for a check-in this afternoon, a status update to see when they might be able to open. That's already 4 months behind schedule. The Morrisville facility did open in January, but that was supposed to open in the fall. We've seen budget overruns. What about the mental health projects that have been a priority in your first term in office?
Well, we're doing great. And, you know, let's just keep this all in context. We're managing a crisis situation right now. As we all remember, we lost our only mental health hospital in the flood in the middle of the night during Irene. And we have been scrambling ever since. So I don't
want our only state hospital.
Our only state hospital, exactly, for our most critically ill patients. So I don't want to pretend to you that everything's beautiful. It is not. It's been a constant challenge for us, and we're still managing in a crisis because we don't have the beds we once had. But this is the progress we've made. We now have 14 beds, Brattleboro Retreat, beautiful, state-of-the-art facility, serving that southeast corner of the state. We have 6 beds open in Rutland, well-kept secret in Vermont. 6 beds, beautiful state-of-the-art. They're doing a great job there. Morrisville is open. It's temporary. It's only a 3-year gap to help us fill this gap. We have broken ground on a state-of-the-art 26-bed facility in Berlin. So our critical care beds are being built as we beef up our community-based care, which we think will alleviate the need for more critical care beds. In other words, like any disease, hit it early, hit it at home, quality care in community, and you avoid, you know, the extraordinary critical care that's needed. So we're making great progress, but we still have one arm tied behind our back because we don't have enough beds yet because of the loss of beds in Irene. So I don't want to pretend that it's great. This keeps us up at night.
That is all the time we have for today. Tomorrow, therapy dogs help more than just the patients they're designed to work with. Clearly a different topic on the show tomorrow. When Ripton writer Sue Halpern and her dog Pransky began visiting a local nursing home as a therapy dog team, Halpern learned some interesting things about herself and the virtues we all try to live by. If you have an experience with a therapy animal or a question for Sue Halpern, you can email it to vermontedition@vpr.net and join us for that discussion tomorrow at noon. Our program is produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sage Van Wing. We have production assistance from Tim Johnson. Mary Williams directed the program. Our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. And our theme music was composed by Grace Potter and the Nocturnals. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.